Dave's work is a combination of careful work on fundamental physics and visionary ideas for what we can do in the future. And when looking last night at his publications, I was noticing, for instance, that his most highly cited paper is an 18-page Physical Review A. And there are not many people that can claim to have so many citations as he does to such a long paper. But it's because fundamental physics requires careful analysis of all possible systematics. But soon after that, it is a single-author Physical Review Letters about a new kind of quantum computer. So that kind of tells you about the nice mix. And both of these topics are going to be touched upon by today's colloquium, where the common theme is not only molecular physics, but also a passion for physics that's certainly undaunted by large challenges. So please help me in welcoming.
Well, thanks for the nice introduction, Joseph, and I'd like to thank Joseph and Eric Poppitz for the invitation. It's been a really interesting day, really a lot of interesting work going on in the department here. So as Joseph said, the work in my group at Yale is really spanning a whole range of topics, but all sort of centering around the basic technology of using diatomic molecules as tools to study problems in physics that I think of as more fundamental. We're not interested in the properties of molecules per se, but only using them to get at deeper questions. And this slide sort of shows a variety of things that we're doing. We have four different experiments in my lab. I won't have time to tell you about all of them. I'll focus instead on two of them. The first that I'll tell you about is an experiment to look to see if the electron has an electric dipole moment, which, as I'll explain, is a CP-violating effect, which would be evidence of new physics beyond the standard model of particle physics. Then I'll tell you a bit about our essentially technology development, learning how to make sources of molecules down at the low temperatures that have become common in atomic physics. We're learning how to do this now with more complicated objects, and this looks to have a wide range of applications. I'll tell you a bit about one that we've envisioned to make a large-scale quantum computer. There are a whole variety of other things that we can envision. I'll tell you a bit about that as we go along. But I know when I started on this a few years ago, I was trained as an atomic physicist and in some sense a particle physicist, and molecular physics was rather unfamiliar to me. But I think it's worth starting with a quick review of molecular structure from an atomic physicist's point of view. And sort of zeroth order thing that we know about molecules is that they're too bloody complicated. And I actually just learned today that Art Shallow is a Toronto grad, so I'm very happy about the coincidence there. But in general, it seems sort of peculiar that you can use something as complicated as a diatomic molecule to get at interesting questions. But more and more what we're realizing is that the complexity in a molecule, the extra degrees of freedom that I'll tell you about in the next few slides, as we're able to get control over these degrees of freedom, we can actually use them as a resource for a variety of interesting experimental efforts. So now onto the real structure of molecules. Very quick 2-minute summary. The atomic physicist's point of view is that a molecule consists of two atoms. When they're far apart, they just look like separated atoms. When they get close together, there's some sort of a potential well as the atoms bind together. You can imagine at long range, one of the atoms can be in an electronically excited state, and there's a separate, different binding curve for a ground state atom combining with an excited state atom. And as these electron clouds of the two atoms merge, that's what creates a molecule in this potential well. And the typical energy scales here, the separation between these states are atomic scales, so it's order of an electron volt. The depths of these wells are also order of electron volts. The extra structure associated with molecules comes in when we zoom in on the energy scale associated with this potential well. And the first new degree of freedom, the first new energy scale we see is the vibrational structure of the molecule corresponding just, if this were a harmonic potential, it would just be regularly spaced levels. They're indeed anharmonic as you get higher up in the potential wells. So the structure is more complicated. The typical splitting between vibrational levels is perhaps 1% of an electron volt, so 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. Now, if you zoom in once again at a finer energy scale, see there's additional structure associated with the rotation of the molecule. So this is hopefully fairly familiar. The energy is just given by the classical energy, angular momentum squared over 2 times the moment of inertia. The angular momentum is quantized. You get a standard ladder of energy levels with quantized angular momentum and alternating parity. And once again, the typical energy scale for this rotational motion is yet another factor of 100 smaller than the vibration. So some 4 orders of magnitude smaller than the typical electronic energy spacing in atoms. And for most of the experiments that I'll tell you about today, it's really this rotational motion, this small energy splitting associated with the rotation, which is the resource that we're taking advantage of to do new types of experiments. So, and in particular, both the experiments I'll tell you about today are using polar molecules. And I think it's worth just pausing for a moment to talk about what does a polar molecule really look like. The last time, well, before I moved to Yale, that I had seriously thought about molecules was when I took high school chemistry, where my teachers naturally told me a polar molecule, like sodium chloride, consists of a positive charge here and a negative charge here with a stick holding them together, which, from the quantum mechanical point of view, is actually deeply misleading. Because if we think about the actual energy eigenstates of a molecule, an isolated molecule in free space, they're states of quantized angular momentum, and they really look like very, very similar to the wave functions of a hydrogen atom. So, for example, if here I have a molecule consisting of a red atom and a green atom, in the lowest angular momentum state with J equals zero, it's like the S state of a hydrogen atom. The green atom is uniformly distributed about the red atom. And this thing, even if the red atom has a positive charge and the green a negative charge, this uniform distribution means that on average there's no dipole moment. The expectation value of the electric dipole moment for this state is just zero. Likewise, even for excited states like the first rotational state, this is like the P state in a hydrogen atom, and the green atom is just as likely to be found above the red atom as below. Here I've indicated with colors the amplitude of the wave function, but the probability is the square of that. So again, the expectation value of the electric dipole moment of this object is just zero for a true quantum mechanical eigenstate. Nevertheless, you can recover this picture that is so familiar from high school chemistry. If you apply an electric field to this system, we know quantum mechanically the electric field mixes these two states of opposite parity. It's the standard Stark effect. And the mixed states, one state corresponds to the negative superposition with a negative sign, the other to the superposition with a positive sign. And in the two cases, there is constructive interference of the green atom on the bottom for this superposition, constructive interference on the top for this superposition. And this indeed looks like these states in the presence of the electric field do have an expectation value of the electric dipole moment. So this electric field can polarize the molecules. What's perhaps a little surprising is, just as you would expect, in the ground state of the molecule, the polarization of the molecule is along the electric field. It's what you would expect from an electron on a spring model. What's a little less familiar is this first excited state polarizes against the electric field. It's just the quantum eigenstate corresponding to the first excited state of the molecule. And sort of throughout the talk, I'll be using this cartoon picture, sort of back to the high school chemistry charged balls on a stick picture in the presence of an electric field. These are the two lowest energy quantum eigenstates of a molecule, dipole up and dipole down relative to an external field. Once again, just to emphasize here, the much smaller splitting, that is something like 10 to the minus 4 eV, between these rotational states of opposite parity is in contrast to the several eV splitting that's typical for atoms. And this means that molecules have a much larger polarizability than atoms by some 4 orders of magnitude typically. And that's really at the heart of most of the things I'll be telling you about today. So now I'm going to switch gears, sort of go out of my summary of molecular structure and start telling you about one of the two experiments that I'll talk about today, which is an experiment to look for the electric dipole moment of the electron. And just start off by talking a little bit about why would it be interesting to look for such a thing if it were to exist. And one of the first realizations as you try to understand why we're bothering to look for this is to point out that if a if a fundamental quantum particle, like an electron, has an electric dipole moment which is permanent, that is, it has an expectation value even for a quantum eigenstate, this permanent electric dipole moment is evidence for violation of both time reversal and parity symmetries. And there's a fairly easy way to picture that, a pictorial argument. So if you imagine an electron that we know an electron is a ball of charge with spin, or we can think of it as a ball of charge with spin. If the electron has an electric dipole moment, it's equivalent to canceling some of the charge on one side, maybe creating a dent in one side of the electron and a bulge in the other side. And if you think about the spinning ball of charge, if there's a net dipole moment of that particle, it has to be aligned along the angular momentum, the spin angular momentum, because any other component transverse to that will average away as the system rotates. So in contrast to the picture of a molecule I showed you earlier, where the electric dipole moment was perpendicular to the rotation of the molecule, here we're considering something like an electron where there's an electric dipole moment along the angular momentum axis. If you make the supposition that nature is such that all electrons look like this, that they have an electric dipole moment along the axis of their spin, and now you make a time reversal transformation, so run the movie of the universe backwards, it's easy to see what happens. The spin rotates in the other direction, so the spin vector changes sign, but the electric dipole moment doesn't know about the direction of time. And hence you see that your supposition, if you suppose that all electrons look like this, the nature is therefore not symmetric under time reversal, because this time reversed version of that object doesn't exist according to your supposition. And really, this T violation is the most interesting part of electric dipole moments, but just parenthetically point out this also violates parity, since the electric dipole moment changes sign, but the spin, which is an axial vector, does not. So again, under a parity transformation, if this is what all electrons look like, these don't exist, and the universe is not symmetric under parity. From the particle physics point of view, it's a well-known theorem in quantum field theory that the combined symmetry of charge conjugation, parity, and time reversal is conserved in quantum field theory. So according to this theorem, which is on very solid theoretical ground, this violation of time reversal is equivalent to a violation of CP symmetry. And this is really one of the hot topics in particle physics now. There are a couple of dedicated accelerator facilities that are really entirely devoted to studying CP violation. And in general, the presence of CP or equivalently T violation in particle physics is a great mystery, but also seems to be maybe intimately connected with physics that appears at the next highest energy scales. So we're interested in looking for an electric dipole moment of an electron. And it's worth just quickly making the connection between that phenomenon, which is a low-energy phenomenon that we see in a tabletop apparatus, or we look for in a tabletop apparatus, and how does that connect to physics at very high energy scales? What does this have to do with particle physics? And essentially, in a very crude way, you can think of this electric dipole moment as being associated with a cloud of virtual particles that accompanies every quantum particle in the language of field theory. So, for example, in the standard model of particle physics, the electron and every other fundamental particle has an electric dipole moment, which is not zero. But it turns out in the standard model, the electric dipole moment of the electron is extraordinarily small for a couple of reasons. One is that the mechanism that induces CP violation in the standard model is a rather strange mechanism. And the net result is the way that CP violation enters and can induce an EDM requires a very high order loop diagram. Essentially, you can think of the number of loops in this diagram as telling you the order of perturbation theory. So in the standard model, fourth order perturbation theory is required to generate an electron electric dipole moment. And moreover, there are many loops, many diagrams of this type with multiple loops, which tend to cancel each other very strongly in the standard model. So the electron-electric dipole moment is non-zero, but very, very small in the standard model. By contrast, in theories that are now in favor among particle theorists, such as, for example, supersymmetry, a much simpler diagram, in fact, even a first-order perturbation theory diagram, can give rise to an electron-electric dipole moment. Here, for example, an electron can virtually emit a selectron, the supersymmetric particle partner of an electron, and a photino, the partner of a photon, and then recombine And this X indicates a source of CP violation, and this diagram can lead to an electric dipole moment. To put this on more concrete terms, this is, again, a sort of cartoon picture that indicates, on this scale, a logarithmic scale of predictions for the electron's electric dipole moment in the standard but rather perverse units of the field. Dipole moment is charge times distance, and we use electron charge times centimeters. The current limit, which comes from an experiment I worked on as a postdoc at Berkeley, is that the electron EDM is smaller than a couple times 10 to the minus 27 e centimeters. And you can see that already this limit is cutting into the predictions of various models other than the standard model, which is down here many orders of magnitude away. But already this limit is causing problems for some theories. And in particular, the blue colors here are different versions of supersymmetry. And the most naive predictions of supersymmetry, what theorists would have really liked to have seen, are already strongly ruled out by this Berkeley result and other similar results in the field. So sort of in response to that, as well as some other known problems with supersymmetry, there have been various tweaks, sort of adjustments to supersymmetry that can that predict typically electric dipole moments that are within a couple of orders of magnitude of the current limit. There are some variants that push the prediction down by many orders of magnitude, but most currently favored theories of particle physics predict an electric dipole moment that's within a factor of 100 or so of the current limit. And the experiment that I'll tell you about now, we're projecting about a factor of 30 improvement in sensitivity, which really cuts into most of these predictions. So we think that we've got a rather good chance of being the first or among the first experiments to see evidence for new physics such as supersymmetry or extra Higgs bosons and such. So this is really the motivation for our experiments. Now let me tell you a bit about how these work. And the actual concept of looking for an electric dipole moment is pretty simple, and I'll take you through a rather cartoonish version of this, but it gets the basic ideas across. So we start in most experiments with a sample of unpolarized electrons whose spins and hence their electric dipole moments are pointing in random directions. The first step in these experiments is to polarize the sample, typically by applying some light and transferring, for example, the circular polarization of light into the spin polarization of the electrons. So, for example, we can imagine preparing a sample of spins polarized in the sideways direction. Quantum mechanically, that's a superposition of spin up and spin down. For technical reasons, most of these experiments use a magnetic field, which is applied perpendicular to the spins. Because the electrons surely have a magnetic dipole moment, they feel a torque, and like a gyroscope, they start to precess around this magnetic field at a frequency which is just proportional to the magnetic field and the magnetic moment. Equivalently, this introduces an energy splitting, a Zeeman splitting between spin up and spin down. And this splitting is just that the frequency corresponding to that energy splitting is the same as this precession frequency, just two different ways of seeing the same thing. And if you imagine measuring this energy or this frequency as a sort of spectral line, you can imagine seeing some signal with a peak at a frequency that corresponds to this precession frequency. To look for an electric dipole moment in these experiments, we apply an electric field parallel to the magnetic field, for example. If the particle, in addition to its magnetic moment, also has an electric dipole moment, this exerts an additional torque and causes the thing to precess faster, or equivalently causes spin up and spin down to split by more, or equivalently causes the spectral line to shift over. Unfortunately, the effect we're looking for is so small, we can never calibrate the size of this magnetic field sufficiently to simply measure the absolute difference between the frequency we see and what we should see. Instead, we do something easier, which is to set up the experiment like this and then reverse the electric field and look for the precession frequency or the splitting to get smaller, the spectral line to shift. Then we sit down and reverse the electric field back and forth and look for synchronous changes in this precession frequency, synchronous with the reversal of the electric field. And we essentially flip this back and forth for as long as we can stand, something like the lifetime of a graduate student in the laboratory. But this simple picture allows you to write down a very simple figure of merit for knowing how well your experiment can do, at least in principle, which is figure of merit is how big is the energy shift associated with this divided by how good is your energy resolution. The energy shift is given by the electron's dipole moment. That's given by nature. We can't control that. But that dipole moment multiplied by the electric field. So the bigger the electric field, the better your experiment. Then your energy resolution is given by the width of this spectral line, which is just, according to the energy time uncertainty principle, or just Fourier transforms, that's 1 over the time that you can observe a typical spin in the system before losing track of its direction. And then your ability to see a shift is also determined by the signal-to-noise on this spectral line. If you put this all together, the figure of merit depends on the electric field, the coherence time, the counting rate, which determines signal-to-noise, and finally, this integration time, which is fixed by the lifetime of a graduate student. So the sort of the key trick that we're using to, we believe, soon get much better sensitivity is to embed our electrons inside a polar molecule, in our case, lead oxide. And as I explained before, by applying a rather modest external electric field, because the polarizability of the molecule is so high, you can completely polarize the system. Then the electron, most of the time, the valence electrons, most of the time spend their time in between the lead and the oxygen atoms, where they feel the internal field of the molecule, which one can do a simple back-of-the-envelope estimate, and see that internal field, which is a few atomic units of field, is something enormous, something like 10 to the 10 volts per centimeter, rough estimate. And you get that when you only have by only applying something like 10 volts per centimeter in the laboratory to polarize this molecule. Now, in some sense, the molecule acts as a very efficient amplifier of electric field and ends up giving us this internal field, which is orders of magnitude larger than you can get in the laboratory by applying voltages to plates. Simply have material break down at much, much lower fields than this. So embedding the electrons in this molecule gives us a big enhancement in electric field. Of course, to actually know what this field is, you have to do explicit calculations of the electron wave functions to know how they're distributed in the molecule. There are now two different calculations of this effect that agree or disagree, depending on your point of view, within a factor of 2. But the order of magnitude is just what you would expect from a naive argument, which is this internal field is somewhere in the range of about 3 times 10 to the 10 volts per centimeter in our case. So that's the basic idea, but now let me take you through in a few steps how the experiment actually works. And in order to do that, I have to, again, bump into some molecular structure. In our case, because we're interested in looking for this electron-electric dipole moment, which is coupled to the spin of the electron, we need a molecule that has an unpaired electron spin. And this is an extra degree of freedom that I didn't tell you about in this simple picture of molecular structure. But we have to take it into account. In fact, for our molecules, for a variety of reasons, we chose a molecule where the state of interest is not just one unpaired electron spin, but two unpaired spins that form a triplet state. So essentially, this molecule, superposed on its rotation, has an extra degree of freedom associated with this two-spin triplet, a spin-one system, that can point, you can imagine, arbitrary directions relative to the molecular axis. In practice, what this boils down to is that for the non-rotating molecule, the molecule with no angular momentum, the spin added to that gives it an angular momentum of 1, which you can never get rid of. And that extra degree of freedom of which way the spin points relative to the molecular axis actually gives you a doubling of states, so that angular momentum 1 associated with spin 1 plus no rotation can coupled to the molecular axis in either a symmetric or anti-symmetric superposition, and hence give two states of opposite parity and spin projections plus 1, 0, or minus 1. This is a little complicated, but it actually gets simpler when we apply an electric field to polarize the system. Now we see that when we apply the electric field, these two states mix and repel each other. Some of the states went down in energy. In order to do this, they must have polarized along the electric field. That's the energetically favorable condition. Some of the states must have polarized opposite the electric field. That's the energetically unfavorable superposition. And we end up with this sort of X-shaped level diagram, where from top to bottom, we have molecule polarized up or down, or sorry, down or up, rather. And from left to right, we have electron spin down, sideways, and up. The way the experiment works is this triplet state is actually an excited, electronically excited state, which is metastable. We populate it by driving population from the molecular ground state with a laser up into this particular sublevel. Then we apply a pulse of radio frequency field to drive into a coherent superposition of these two states, which are spin up and spin down. And as we know, a superposition of spin up and spin down is equivalent to spin sideways. And now we're back to this simple picture that I told you. We have a molecule that's polarized in a particular direction, an electron inside that with its spin perpendicular to the molecular polarization. So that's just what we want. Now the internal electric field of the molecule can apply a torque to these electrons if they have an electric dipole moment and cause them to precess around the internal field. And again, for technical reasons, we also apply a magnetic field parallel to the electric field. That causes a Zeeman splitting between spin up and spin down, which again is equivalent to some spectral line corresponding to this splitting between spin up and spin down. So now if I sort of recap this picture, everything I told you before sort of set up the basic experimental situation, but I didn't tell you what it looks like if there's an electric dipole moment. But again, it's just like I said before, we start with population here, drive to a superposition of these states, which is equivalent to spin sideways or a superposition of up and down. Now if there is an electric dipole moment, there's an additional splitting between these states that depends on the relative sign of the electric field. So this splitting between these levels, equivalently this spectral line, will shift back and forth as we reverse the electric field. So that's sort of the classic electric dipole moment experiment. But it turns out in our system we have an extra way to control the system, which is new to these sorts of experiments, which is we can leave the electric field alone and instead change the frequency of this driving pulse. So that instead of driving population to this pair of levels, we drive population to the lower pair of levels. You see what's happened here is we've left the external electric field alone, but we've effectively reversed the polarization of the molecule. So the electrons internal to the molecule feel the electric field change sign and they precess in the opposite direction. So by leaving the electric field alone and changing the frequency of this resonant drive pulse, we can again reverse the direction of the effect and change the position of this spectral line. And of course, we can also stay here and reverse the electric field. But crucial point here is that this ability to compare the molecule polarized along the field and molecule polarized against the field is really a new concept in this field. We think of it as an internal co-magnetometer, which is some funny jargon, but the basic idea is that systematic effects which are associated with changing the electric field. So, for example, there may be a leakage current associated with this electric field that can interact with the magnetic dipole moment of the electron. Systematic effects will cancel when we do this comparison without having to change the external field. And in fact, all of the systematics that have been problematic in other experiments, previous generation experiments of this type, seem to be completely killed by this comparison. So we think that in addition to good statistical sensitivity, we'll also have an unusual degree of control over systematics. So this was an idea that we really started with when I arrived at Yale about 7 years ago now, and I told one of my old mentors, Stuart Freeman, about this, and he said, you know, that looks like a beautiful idea, Dave, but you really should be aware that, you know, how particle physics really works. There's this relationship between theorists, experimentalists, and facts, which is like that between a farmer, a pig, and a truffle. You know, the theorist sends you out to dig in the dirt, looking for the beautiful, beautiful object of desire, the truffle. And even if you're lucky enough to find it, the theorist will then just yank it away from you and use it for their own purposes, send you back out to dig in the dirt again. I saw Stuart a few years later, and he said, "Dave, I didn't mean you to take that literally." With that in mind, maybe just tell you a little bit about the particular dirt that we've had to dig in for this experiment. We've had to learn how to make vapor cells, high-density vapor cells of lead oxide molecules. That was a very difficult task. We solved this by using big, complex machine blocks of high purity ceramics with single crystal sapphire windows glued on using gold foils as a peculiar sort of glue. We surround this whole thing with an oven, which is created out of pieces of quartz with hundreds of grooves machined in it. And this whole thing took us several years to figure out how to build. But now it's working quite well. What we've got now, we've gone through a sort of proof of principle stage of the experiment and are in the final stages of engineering before taking real data. Basic idea, we have this vapor cell surrounded by a heater that heats it up. Pulse laser excites the molecules. After about 100 microseconds, the state decays and emits a visible fluorescent photon. The direction of the emission of that photon, or that photon, is emitted in a dipole radiation pattern. And the direction of that radiation pattern is coupled to the direction of the spin in the electron state. So, for example, if we apply a magnetic field, the spin starts to precess around the magnetic field. The dipole radiation pattern rotates. We can pick that up on a photomultiplier tube and see some oscillating signal at this precession frequency, and then an exponential decay corresponding to the lifetime of this state. And here's some typical real data from our lab of what this looks like. This is all working quite well. And the bottom line is that we've learned how to build all the crazy technologies that were needed to make this work. Everything works more or less as expected. We've explicitly seen that these upper and lower states have the same magnetic properties, so that they should be very effective at rejecting systematics. And bottom line is we've been putting all the engineering pieces together, and we expect to take useful EDM data really within the next few weeks. And we're shooting for about a factor of 30 improvement. Well, we're hoping for within 2 years. We're sort of bumping into the deadline that's set for us by the Large Hadron Collider, which is really our clear competition in the race to see supersymmetry or other physics beyond the standard model. Okay, so this is the end of the first part of my talk. I've been telling you about this electric dipole moment experiment. Now I'm going to really completely switch gears and tell you about another piece of our work where, as I said, we've been developing sources for polar molecules at very low temperatures. And let me start off by telling you a bit about why we're trying to do this. And it seems that there are actually many, many applications for this technology once we get it working. And really what started my interest was the idea that having very cold molecules would allow you to do the sort of precision measurements of the type that I was just telling you about in a much better way. Essentially, again, if you think about that last experiment, we're essentially trying to measure frequency shifts in a certain system. And as a system gets colder, observation times can get longer, spectral lines get narrower, and you have better sensitivity to small shifts in spectral lines. In addition, we can use this enhancement of the effect due to the molecular structure. For example, for the electron-electric dipole moment, the large polarizability gives us a big enhancement of the electric field. And it turns out you can get similar enhancements in all sorts of other interesting experiments, things like parity violation measurements of properties of the Z boson, tests of time variation of fundamental constants, where the enhancement factors range from 3 orders of magnitude to an absolutely incredible 11 orders of magnitude. So for example, this parity violating effect in some molecules can be an order unity effect in our systems. But in addition to these sort of improved experiments, there are a whole host of new applications possible if you can have ultra-cold molecules. Things like quantum coherent molecular dynamics, chemical reactions at zero temperature, sorts of novel long-range molecular states that have no analog in known systems. And in addition, at the really now explosively growing interface between atomic physics and condensed matter physics, we think that these polar molecules could really open up a whole new regime. The point here is that if you take two of these molecules, put them in an electric field to electrically polarize them, the electric dipole-dipole interaction is extraordinarily strong by the standards of atomic physics. In addition, you can turn the electric field off, turn the polarization off, and then get sort of normal scale interaction strengths. So this electrical polarization gives you a very convenient knob to turn on or off to tune interactions that are extremely strong, They're very long range. They're also anisotropic, which is unusual for atomic interactions. The combination of these things can really take you into some new regimes. There are a variety of ideas for sort of quantum phases and such that have been discussed. But as an example of this, let me tell you about our idea for doing large-scale quantum computation with these cold molecules. And here's a sort of cartoon picture of what a quantum computer based on polar molecules would look like. The idea is to have, just for simplicity, let's think about a one-dimensional linear array of individual molecules held in a regular array due to a trap that's known as an optical lattice, basically just a standing wave laser beam. And basic features of this, the quantum bits in the system are these electric dipole moments of polarized molecules, dipole up or down relative to an electric field. The register for the system is this regular array of bits in the optical lattice. The optical lattice provides a very weak trapping potential, so it's really necessary to have these molecules very cold in order to hold them in the trap at all. The processor here is really, it's the complete analog of NMR. That is, one can do radio frequency electric resonance to flip the bit over. By applying electric field gradient to this system, the frequency that's required to flip this bit is different than the frequency to require this bit because the energy is dipole moment times electric field. So just purely spectroscopic addressing is possible in an array like this, and that's a very robust technology. As I'll explain in the next slide, to do quantum computation, you need interactions, and here the interaction is this strong electric dipole-dipole interaction, and this enables gate speeds of up to about 100 kilohertz for this system. The decoherence here should allow rather long times for coherent evolution. Believe that if you work hard, this could be dominated by scattering of photons from the laser that provides the trap itself, and here there's a coupling between the weaker you can make this trap, the lower the scattering rate, and the weaker you make this trap, the colder the molecules have to be. But with some reasonable-looking numbers, we can imagine decoherence times up to almost 10 seconds. This would correspond to up to about a million coherent operations for this system. There are standard atomic physics techniques for readout of this. I won't say much about that. But in the end, it's rather easy to imagine scaling this thing up to in an early version, 10,000, and in later versions, even 10 million bits looks eminently reasonable for this. And here we take advantage of what's now known physics in the atomic physics community, so-called mod insulator transition, which you can think of as a sort of self-assembly technique for large arrays of single particles in these optical lattices. So really the crucial idea for molecules here is the fact that these electric dipole-dipole interactions are strong enough to allow fast gates. And for those of you who are not familiar with this, just take you through the argument that conditional logic gates, such as a controlled NOT gate in a quantum computer, really require strong interactions between bits. And the basic idea is pretty simple. If you think about a two-bit system, bit A and bit B, and these two bits have state 0 and 1, they're two-level systems, but the energy to excite bit A is different from the energy to excite bit B. So here, this small gap is the energy to excite bit A. The larger gap is the energy to excite bit B. And you can imagine with a spectroscopic technique, a controlled NOT gate means that you would like to flip bit A if bit B is in the 1 state and leave bit A alone if bit B is in the 0 state. But this simple energy level diagram shows you that that's impossible. If you're resonant with this transition, you're also resonant with that transition. But if there are interactions between the bits, so for example, a dipole-dipole interaction which causes the energies to go up if the spins are parallel in the same state and to go down if they're anti-parallel, then there's now an energy difference between this desired transition and the undesired lower transition. And just from the energy-time uncertainty principle, the bigger this difference between this and this, that difference is entirely determined by the interaction. The bigger that difference, the faster you can do an experiment to resolve these two. So big interactions means fast gate speeds for quantum computation. And again, just sort of summarizing this, won't tell you many details, but the basic idea, we're really envisioning that this system scales very naturally to a rather large number of operations, a large number of bits, So I'll argue it's based very heavily on what we've done already. The anticipated performance really crosses some significant thresholds. It's maybe not good enough to go and crack your credit card number on the internet, but it's big enough to really get into a whole new regime for quantum computation. And we think that we may be able to get there sort of faster than some other competing technologies. So now let me tell you a bit about the progress that we made in creating cold molecules. And the most advanced approach in our lab and other labs is really essentially assembling cold molecules out of laser-cooled atoms. So using the technology of laser cooling to get to extremely low temperatures, then trying to stick the atoms together to get cold molecules. The approach we use is called photoassociation. So the basic idea is we start with two atoms in their ground state, which are typically very far apart, and we drive with a strong laser transition from the free state of two atoms, asymptotically free state, to a bound but electronically excited state of a molecule. These are very weak transitions, but we can hold the atoms for a long time and use a strong laser and eventually drive them. Once we get to these electronic excited states have very short lifetimes, on order of 30 nanoseconds or so. These then spontaneously decay, frequently just back to free atoms. The molecule falls apart. But sometimes these states can decay to bound states of the molecule, in which case we now have molecules that are at the same translational temperature as the atoms we started with. To make polar molecules requires trapping two different atomic species, which is a bit painful, since a molecule made of two of the same kind of atoms can't be polar because the charge has no reason to choose one atom over the other if they're the same. But the good news here is that molecules can be formed in a single rotational state at the same translational temperature as the atoms, so down to very low temperatures. The only downside is that in this production, we end up with a bunch of very highly excited vibrational levels populated. And I'll tell you how we deal with that as I go on. But here's some very early results in our lab. Here we monitor the number of atoms. We use rubidium and cesium atoms. We monitor the number of atoms in our trap as a function of the frequency of this photoassociating laser that you can think of as essentially a catalyst for binding the atoms together. And we see very clear signatures at certain frequencies of this laser. Both species of atoms disappear from the trap at the same frequency. There's a characteristic series of lines here which has the right structure to be a series of rotational levels, this excited molecule. And nearby, just to give you an idea, we see a similar series where only cesium atoms disappear, rubidium atoms don't. And here it's clear that we're making cesium-2 molecules. Rather interesting and surprising thing here is that we're able to get order unity conversion from atoms to molecules in this system. That was a bit surprising to us that it's that efficient. And you can see very clearly we can resolve individual rotational levels here. So simply by tuning our laser to a particular one of these dips, we can produce molecules in a single well-defined rotational state. So that rotational degree of freedom is under our control. Again, given my lack of knowledge of chemistry, I was a bit surprised when I learned that rubidium-cesium molecules, rubidium and cesium are both in the leftmost column of the periodic table. I was a bit surprised to learn that those are polar molecules, since I was told that polar molecules were things like sodium chloride, one from this side and one from that side of the periodic table. But indeed, rubidium-cesium was known to be polar. We explicitly verified that. Here's the same spectroscopic picture turned on its side and compared to the case where there's an electric field. And we see the characteristic splitting of these states as we polarize the molecule. And the dipole moment for rubidium-cesium turns out to be about two-thirds the dipole moment of the water molecule. So it's not huge, but it's a perfectly respectable polar molecule. Those last pictures just show you what happens when we create these excited molecules. We'd like to verify that those decay into bound molecular states. So we did this by applying extra lasers, which excite these molecules, then photoionize them. Then we have a simple time-of-flight mass spectrometer to determine what's been ionized in our system. And here's a time-of-flight mass spectrum. The red trace shows what happens when we tune our photoassociation laser off resonance. Blue trace is when it's on resonance, and we very clearly see the presence of rubidium-cesium molecules formed here, as expected. And we can even measure the temperature of the molecules that we formed in this way. We turn off the photoassociation laser, wait for some amount of time. During this time, the molecules that we formed are ballistically expanding out of our detection region. And then by seeing how the signal decays away as a function of the delay time, we can effectively measure the average velocity of the molecules that we formed. And we see that consistent with our expectations, the temperature is about 100 microkelvin, which is about the same as the temperature of the atoms in our system. Sort of the next task in this was dealing with this vibrational excitation that I mentioned before. So again, we drive from free atoms to bound but excited molecules. These molecules can decay into metastable but vibrationally excited molecules. These are translationally cold. They're moving very slowly. They're rotationally cold. They're in a single rotational state. But they're vibrating like crazy. They populate some large spread of levels of high vibrational excitation. And this is really an annoyance. For most of the applications we have in mind, these vibrationally excited molecules are really quite useless. One collision and they'll typically lose their energy and leave the system. They also have essentially no dipole moment. They have negligible polarity in the language of chemists, essentially because these high vibrational levels correspond to atoms that are very far apart on average, and the electron clouds simply don't merge for these high vibrational states. But the idea for dealing with this is to add more lasers to the system to drive this state up to an excited state and back down into the absolute vibrational ground state. And doing this will leave us with a sample of truly ultra-cold molecules, molecules that are cold in all their degrees of freedom, their translation, their rotation, and their vibration. And this is really the starting point for all these applications that I mentioned before, including the quantum computer built from polar molecules. But as you can see, we've now counted lots of lasers in this system, and this is actually a picture of our lab where you can only see about half the lasers. We end up with 7 tunable lasers and about 11 total lasers. It's a little bit complicated, but it's all working pretty well. And just earlier this year, we published a paper indicating that we're able to do this transfer into the molecular ground state. We take some molecules that we've detected, vibrationally excited molecules that we've detected. We pump them using one pulse laser into an excited state and then stimulate them to emit with another pulse laser down into the vibrational ground state. To actually see that this has happened, we drive this process, wait a while, then drive back up to an excited state and photoionize this and look for the resulting ions. When we do this and look as a function of the frequency of this laser that drove us down and drove us back up, we see a peak at exactly the frequency that was expected in order to drive this transition to the vibrational ground state. And as we tune the laser, we see no peaks until exactly the frequency that was expected to get into the first vibrational excited level. So this is a very clear signature that we've been able to drive the molecules into their vibrational ground state. We've done this for a number of intermediate states. I think the signals are very clear. We were able to get something like 8% efficiency from the highly excited state down to the ground state. We understand what the limitation is there. It's just our relatively poor lasers. Where are we going with this? Well, the next thing we're going to do is start trapping our atoms in an optical lattice trap. Photoassociate in this trap that will accumulate vibrationally excited molecules. We'll apply this series of laser pulses to drive the molecules into their vibrational ground state. At the end of this, we have this sort of soup of trapped atoms, vibrationally excited molecules of various states, and the ones that we really care about, which are ground state molecules. Now, to get rid of all the other stuff, we'll play a trick. We'll use some electrodes, apply an electric field gradient, which creates a trapping potential only for the molecular ground state, which have a big dipole moment, a big polarizability. Turn off a retroreflected beam, turn this lattice into a dipole trap. Effectively, gravity will allow everything except the molecules we want to drain out of this trap, and we'll be left with a pure sample of ground state polar molecules. And for experts, to give you an idea of what we think we're going to be able to get to this, it's a few tens of thousands of molecules at moderate densities and temperatures. And this will truly be the starting point for the kinds of applications that I've told you about. So again, just to summarize, we've demonstrated that we can produce ultra-cold ground state polar molecules. Temperatures are now only about 100 microkelvin, but it's obvious if we just start with colder atoms, we'll get colder molecules, and there are standard techniques for doing that. The formation rates and efficiencies are quite good, and we know how to make them better, so large samples of these ultra-cold polar molecules appear to be in reach, and we're very excited about this. We think this is going to open up whole new frontiers in a variety of subfields. And with that, I'll finish, end by thanking the members of my group. There are other people shown here working on other experiments that I didn't talk about. I'll particularly point out David Glenn, who is a Toronto undergrad, who's working on an experiment I didn't talk about, but you're welcome to send any more students like him my way. Particularly Dave Kawal, postdoc on the lead oxide experiment, and Jamie Kerman, who's not shown here, postdoc on the cold molecule experiments. So thanks for your attention.
Are there any questions? Well, let me start out asking. Tell us a little bit about this crazy vapor cell you said had to have these materials. Why did you need this temperature, and why did you need all these materials?
Right. So in order to get good statistical sensitivity, we want large counting rates in our experiment. And the way that we're trying to do that is to just have lots of molecules, so a high density of this molecular vapor. We knew that one of the reasons we chose lead oxide is it seemed in principle that it was possible to do that just by heating up a vapor cell to temperatures of order 700 C in our case. And it's standard to use vapor cells at that temperature. Fortunately, lead oxide, as we learned to our embarrassment, we made a quart cell of lead oxide, but it turns out mixing lead oxide with silicon oxide, constituent of quartz, is a sort of ancient technique for creating lead glass, which has a very low melting point. So our quartz cell filled with lead oxide gave us a puddle of molten goo at the bottom of our system. And we quickly learned that while lead oxide has many good properties for us, there are very few materials that can withstand it, contact with it, up at these temperatures. And things like ceramic, sapphire, noble metals are among the few things that can withstand contact with lead oxide. So now that we know how to do that, it's fairly routine, but it took a while to invent that technology. There have been all sorts of other similar things that I can tell you about over a beer. Things that we invented that no one else in the world cares about, but we need to make the experiment work. So. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So the experiment is really run pulsed. So the RF is turned on, turned off. In fact, I didn't tell you about this, but the RF is really microwaves that we feed in via a microwave horn, 30 gigahertz microwaves. So it's switched on, switched off, and then we look at the molecules when everything is switched off. So, I mean, of course, in principle, one can have technical issues like that, but... Well, we haven't actually taken data yet, so we'll see. But we certainly don't anticipate any serious effects. In part because we've found that in practice these microwaves, these very high frequency microwaves, decouple from DC electronics pretty well. Yes. Right, so there are two key things. One is, as I said, we need a molecule with an unpaired electron spin, and those are chemically free radicals. So there are always issues dealing with unpaired electron spins. It has to be polar, so that we can apply an electric field and polarize the molecules. So something like oxygen is nonpolar. That doesn't work. And then finally, I didn't mention this, and in fact, this is something that I deeply swept under the rug, but if you think about it for a minute, you'll convince yourself that I was really lying to you. This picture that the electron is sitting in a molecule and feeling an electric field is absurd on its face, because, by God, an electron may or may not have an electric dipole moment, but it has a charge. And if you apply an electric field to it, it ought to be accelerating like crazy. At 10 to the 10 volt per centimeter electric field, it ought to be accelerating. So something's wrong with that picture. And in fact, it ends up being right, but the key is that you can apply an electric field to the electron in this molecule to the extent that there's a spin orbit force that cancels, a magnetic force that cancels the electric force. And spin orbit effects grow very rapidly with the atomic number Z. So for that reason, we actually want lead. We want something very heavy like lead, because the effect actually scales like Z cubed, as it turns out. So we wanted something heavy, we wanted something polar, we wanted something that we knew how to make a paramagnetic state out of, and that limited the number of choices very, very severely. There are competing experiments using other molecules. For example, the molecule ytterbium fluoride. Ytterbium is, again, a heavy atom. Ytterbium fluoride has a single unpaired electron state. That molecule is an honest-to-God free radical in its ground state, so you can only make it under sort of deeply non-equilibrium conditions. And they, their experiment has some advantages, but their counting rates are smaller than ours by some 6 or 7 orders of magnitude. The work has paid off for us in a big way. Yeah, right. I mean,
and,
what
is their sensitivity expected to be when they turn on?
Well, it's competition in an indirect way. So the LHC, of course, will be directly probing all phenomena at high energy scales. We indirectly probe some integrated set of phenomena at high energy scales that have to do with CP violation. I have to say I would be very pleased if we saw an effect before the LHC turned on. Because the standard model predicts an EDM which is so small, if we see something that's not zero and not a systematic effect, it really has to indicate new physics at an energy scale that no one has seen before. It may be that, a month later the LHC turns on and says, aha, here's the series of supersymmetric particles that can explain your electric dipole moment. There's complementarity in the sense that the LHC, for example, will have a very hard time probing CP violation up at these high energy scales. So, the information is complementary, but, the impact would surely be greater if we were the first to see this evidence of new physics at high energy scales. I would be quite happy about that. But we won't just shut down and turn off when the LHC starts producing data either.